Welcome to the Informed Pregnancy and Parenting Podcast. You're listening to part two of Reach Babies 101. I'm Dr. Elliot Berlin, and I'm joined by our guests, Dr. Barry Brock, Beth Cannon, midwife, Susan Minnick, midwife, and Dr. Milo Shavira. So Susan's here. Susan's an acupuncturist, and you do a lot of breech acupuncture. I know because we share patients.
We share patients,
back and forth.
Yes.
Tell me, what is acupuncture and or Chinese medicine in general, because it's not just acupuncture. What do you do for breech babies, and how does it work?
So in Chinese medicine, the theory of acupuncture is there are channels or meridians that circulate through the body, and they're like blood vessels. You can't see them, and they carry our circulation of blood and what we call in Chinese medicine qi, which is our energy. Mm-hmm. And these channels connect and nourish the entire body and circulate through all the internal organs, and everything's connected. It's not like in Western medicine where one organ, you take care of the heart, you take care of your headaches. In Chinese medicine, it's all connected.
Holistic.
So, yes. And when ladies are pregnant and the circulation can get impeded from, as the circulation comes up from the lower half of the body, the circulation gets, the meridians get stuck and things don't flow well. And it's just like a garden hose. You get the garden hose pinched, you unravel the garden hose and you can water your plants. Or you turn the light switch on, you don't see the wires behind the wall, but you know they're there to turn the lights off and on. Same thing in Chinese medicine or the acupuncture, the needles move energy from place to place. So all these meridians have different points and they're all connected with the internal organs, liver, spleen, kidney, bladder. The channels that run up the side of the body, the bladder channel, has 67 points. And on bladder 67, that we call the urinary bladder 67, is the breech point that everybody talks about for moxibustion. And moxibustion is artemisia or mugwort. It's a heating herb that you warm up a stick that looks like charcoal or it looks like a sponge and you light that. I use that kind where it's smoking moxa. And you place it close to the baby toe. The theory is that this increased circulation warms the meridians, carries the circulation through the body, and a part of the channel circulates around the uterus and increases fetal circulation. It's not anything major, but it has to do with movement and increasing blood flow and circulation to the baby.
Now, I'm going to say this to somebody who has no holistic, you know, alternative medicine background. That sounds absolutely crazy, but...
Right.
Crazy herb at the toe and baby starts moving around. But in practice, we feel sometimes we actually do the moxa while I'm doing the chiropractic work, which I'll speak about in a minute. And you just within 10 minutes, 15 minutes, you start feeling the baby kick around.
Yes.
Now that's anecdotal, but it was also studied and published in the Journal of American Medical Association.
The only one that had a randomized control.
I have the studies here, yeah.
But my feeling is that for these non-dangerous techniques of all these things here, go for it.
There's right, no downside, you have nothing
risk
to lose.
That's same with inversion,
yeah.
I'd say.
I also do acupuncture as well as, I don't just do moxibustion. So for me as an acupuncturist, I work with the mother's fear about birth. I work with her fear about why is my baby breech. So when I do acupuncture on my pregnant ladies, it's very important that I work on points to help calm the mind, spirit, and also the body. And it increases circulation to the heart. And in Chinese medicine, the heart is the center of love and creation. I work on the spirit points to calm the mother, to connect her energy with the baby. And I also do the acupuncture points that relax the ligaments. So I put points on the body to relax the ligaments as well as moxibustion. So when the patients come see me for acupuncture, it's not just about doing the herb with the mugwort. I also do acupuncture. And then I send the moms home with the moxa stick. So in the office, I do the treatment for about 10 to 15 minutes. I send the moms home with instruction. I give them a stick that looks like a piece of charcoal. You light it, it's smokeless. You hold it on the edge of the baby toe for 10 to 15 minutes, two times a day. Now, the literature shows us that you can do 20 minutes for once a day. But I like the patients to connect and relax for 10 minutes with their partner and do it twice a day if they can for 10 minutes.
The moxa makes me sleepy.
When you say the baby toe, you're talking about the mom's?
The mom's baby toe. Thank you. I know. I'm sorry. Yes.
The
mom's baby toe.
The pinky toe.
The pinky toe. Thank you.
Pinky toe.
The pinky toe.
One's a toe and one's an actual baby.
On an inversion? No.
I have them sitting on a table with their, just sitting up, propped up, relaxing. I play music, incense, the whole thing, and they relax. Because a lot of times, the mothers are so worried about this breech baby and not having the baby turn, that I just want to relax them and have them know that they've done everything possible for themselves in case the baby doesn't turn. I have about 50% success rate. I also work with Elliot and other chiropractors that send their patients to me who do the Webster technique, which Elliot will speak about. But the moxibustion is really a wonderful tool to help increase circulation and help the mothers relax and help the baby turn. It doesn't happen all the time. There's a study out that the babies, for the external version, the mothers have a higher success rate of the external version when they do moxibustion and acupuncture.
Absolutely.
And usually within 2 to 3 days is when we see the baby turn. It doesn't happen right away, and you just have to give it time. But yeah, it won't happen in the acupuncture office. I have a lot of patients saying, well, what happens if my baby flips now? I teach the moms how to feel the baby. I also teach them to go on spinningbabies.com, mm-hmm, the Rebozo technique, and different positions of getting on all fours when the baby's active, all the things that we talk to the moms about. I give them printed papers and literature so they see the baby toe and they know how it works. But it increases circulation and also it relaxes the smooth muscle of the uterus.
The Chinese medicine is really synergistic with what we do chiropractically.
Yes.
From a chiropractic perspective, we see about 2 or 3 breech babies a day now in the office. And we get a good number of them to turn, about 2/3 overall. And because of that, people think we're physically doing like an external version, but we will never push a baby in the office, against any kind of resistance. It's not what we're trying to do. We're not trying to do something to the baby. What we're trying to do is increase the pelvic function of the mother. So if you have a lot of tension because you have tight muscles, as Dr. Brock mentioned earlier, sometimes runners, dancers, gymnasts have this very athletic pelvis, mm-hmm, where the muscles down low are so strong and tight, they're pushing in and lifting up on where the baby's head would want to go down or where the butt would want to come out, and they're just gripped in there. Sometimes the muscles in the back, deep inside the gluteal muscles, the piriformis muscles, when they're tight, squeeze everything closed. And the pelvis is supposed to be really dynamic. So if you have all that tension down there and a good amount of amniotic fluid, why would a baby even want to be down there? They can be under your rib cage where there's so much more space. But also, how are they going to get down there if they try to move inside you, side to side, and your pelvis is rigidly stuck and closed? They're going to have a lot harder time moving than if we can loosen up those muscles with some massage work. And then chiropractic adjustments to get the joints moving better. That's what we do as the chiropractic technique. The Webster technique, named after Dr. Larry Webster in the 1970s, he was just trying to help prevent dystocia. Like if he wondered why sometimes you have a woman with a really small pelvis and very large baby that comes through in birth easily. And sometimes you have a woman who's been told those hips are made for birthing, and then they have this little baby that gets stuck on the way down. He came down to function. If the pelvis is not able to move and function and assist in bringing the baby down, then you're going to more likely to have problems during birth. So his whole purpose wasn't really about breech; it was to help improve labor. But what he found was, after doing those adjustments, that babies that were breech would all of a sudden start to settle head down. Again, not necessarily in the office. We're not trying to get come in breech, leave head down, but in between visits, like you mentioned. Fabiola, do you have a question?
Yeah, I'm not a runner, gymnast, or swimmer, or anything like that, but I have been in various automobile accidents.
Sure, and that has the same, different but similar effect in making your pelvis less functional. You've had trauma to your pelvis.
That was my question. Is
lock up and guard
trauma? Yeah, I've gone to a chiropractic before. I have a herniated disc between mm-hmm. L4 and my L5, and that's one of the things that I was thinking was, I need to loosen those areas up because
I need to loosen those areas up.
Well, you need to.
Any kind of trauma, car accidents, fall off a ladder, fall off a horse, snowboarders who are constantly falling on their butt but don't realize they're being traumatized because they're having a good time. They also tend to have that kind of rigid, locked up pelvis.
Yeah, and one of my concerns to go to a chiropractor immediately was just in December of last year. I was 5 months pregnant and we were driving. We were T-boned on the side of where I was sitting.
Wow.
And, then I found out about this. So immediately I went back to that and I'm like, could it possibly be that? And I was met with resistance. Like, no, if you would have had a problem with the accident, you would have found out then, and that's that. Like, it was just ruled out.
Not necessarily. It's impossible to really connect the dots, but all these things that we're talking about are factors.
Okay.
You know, and that's certainly a factor as
one
well.
One of the major thing the body does, you put a hormone called progesterone, and it has several functions, and that's, you know, in the beginning of the pregnancy, number one, you get much more indigestion because it relaxes the sphincter that goes from your stomach to your esophagus, and therefore more acid comes up there. But the reason this hormone does this, it relaxes the ligaments. So your bones, your pelvis stretches out a little more room. It makes it more uncomfortable walking, things like this. But this is one of the reasons in pregnancy, Mother Nature's a great system to design everything you have a vaginal delivery. So that everything stretches out, gives them more room.
And that's absolutely true because prior to me being pregnant, I had more lower back pain. I had more sciatic nerve pain.
Yeah.
And as soon as I got pregnant, I was actually scared. I'm like, how am I going to carry this baby?
It's going to be worse.
I'm
going to
be
not.
In pain.
Well, some people can better. Be worse. It depends what you got. Because what happens is you were lucky you said you gained 7 pounds.
Yeah,
you
total.
57 pounds. Yes. That can be a major
everything.
Difference.
Yeah, so I was pleasantly surprised that, like, wow, I feel better.
The worst thing for your back is to gain weight and have a lordosis.
Yeah.
When you're pregnant, you gain weight and you get a lordosis.
Lordosis is where the low back curve is being pulled forward. And so when you gain weight and you have that baby growing out forward, that pinches your low back in a very uncomfortable way. So it's good. I think people like you that have pain before the pregnancy and then feel better because of the relaxant and maybe some of the progesterone probably go on and have like 35 or 40 babies because you feel so good.
So how much... Now that I'm approaching 37 weeks, like realistically, how much chiropractic care or acupuncture or any of those?
You know, the first visit with chiropractic and massage is also diagnostic. I can get a sense of how your muscles and joints are. Are they incredibly tight, moderately tight? Maybe they're not tight at all. Are the joints moving or are they totally stuck? But then also we'll see how you respond to what we're doing. Sometimes, look, I think that Susan said, even just doing it, if you're going to do an external version, by loosening up that musculature and improving the pelvis there, you're going to create more functional space. Same with the acupuncture and moxa.
I've had two patients at 39 weeks come for acupuncture and moxibustion, and the baby turned at 39 weeks.
Yeah.
One was her second baby, and the ligaments are more relaxed, and the mother's, you know, the multips have a higher success rate. But it's all about relaxing.
But the reason is we pick 37 weeks. Number one, if something happens, I've never had it happen to me, but theoretically doing the version, if the heart rate drops and you have to do a rapid delivery cesarean section, you're 37 weeks and the baby's doing fine. And statistically, if the baby hasn't turned by 37 weeks, it's much less likely to turn after that. In Europe, they'd like to do it earlier.
In Europe?
Europe.
Yeah.
Europe, they'll do breech vaginal.
Just last week, we had a 39-week patient who did the external version and it didn't work for her. Very athletic, very strong musculature. She decided to come in and give us a try anyway because one of her friends had success with us. And, you know, I told her the odds are pretty slim there, and her fluid was very low as well, 7.5. And three or four visits, those muscles got looser and looser, and I kept having her try to increase her fluid a little bit. And boom, right in the middle of one of the sessions, the baby flipped over. I called Dr. Fishbein. I said, you got to bring an ultrasound over here. I'm not sure what I just felt. There was a big movement in there. And lo and behold, her baby's head down.
That's so terrific.
That's 39 weeks. It's it's less common then. Your odds start to go down significantly, but it's not impossible.
Exactly. It's not impossible.
Among the holistic options, just before we get a little more specific about the ECV, there's also hypnotherapy.
Yes, I was just going to say that too. Yeah.
Pulsatilla. Mm-hmm. Hypnotherapy, like you said, Susan, the more relaxed you can be on the inside and outside. Sometimes just by having someone take a deep breath in with my hands on their belly, deep breath in and really relaxing for the first time, you can feel a very significant amount of increased space in there, increased mobility for the baby. So hypnotherapy we use in the office can be incredibly powerful too. Some people respond better to some of these techniques than other ones. And then homeopathy. Beth, do you use Pulsatilla? Or?
Pulsatilla. Ignacia, but Pulsatilla is the most common one. But quite frankly, I think that the chiropractic and the acupuncture with moxa is the ones that do it. And positional changes, the spinning babies, getting the baby out of the pelvis.
Yeah.
You know, then version.
I think the Pulsatilla is delicious.
It can work. And flower essences, they say bougainvillea flower essence.
you have to take everything with a grain of salt. I mean, there's there's a restaurant
like that
here
better.
That people don't go into labor. They go ahead
they go
and
have
a
salad.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're 41, 42 weeks. I went there and I went to labor. Well, yeah. You know, you eventually are going to go into labor.
Right.
So you have to be, all these techniques we're using here, I have no problem trying it, but until you have a scientific randomized controlled study, you really can't say if it really is
sure.
doing the thing. But don't do no harm. That's good.
Yeah, I mean,
exactly. There's no
have
harm.
No downside, and,
right.
and if they're anecdotal,
it's worth a try.
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot about homeopathy, but some of the homeopaths that we work with use
Pulsatilla
exclusively mm-hmm. to try to get babies to turn.
We are going to take a quick commercial break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. This episode is sponsored by an innovative product that's made a big difference for parents and babies alike, Dr. Mom Butt Balm. As a parent of four, I've had my fair share of battles with diaper rash, often resorting to thick, unpleasant pastes. I only recently discovered Dr. Mom Butt Balm, and I was immediately impressed by its pleasant consistency and ease of application. This pediatric-approved skin protectant is free from dyes, preservatives, and zinc oxide, making it perfect for your baby's sensitive skin. It's designed by a doctor who's also a mom, ensuring your little one gets the gentlest care. A small dab is all it takes to soothe and protect, avoiding the mess and hassle of traditional treatments. With ingredients like dimethicone and petrolatum, Dr. Mom Butt Balm not only soothes, but also restores your baby's delicate skin. Available on Amazon.com and Walmart.com, it's the smart choice for every parent wanting to keep diaper rash at bay. Remember, with Dr. Mom Butt Balm, nothing comes between you and your baby. Not even diaper rash.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
All right, so Nusha is joining us. Nusha's 37 weeks.
Tomorrow. Yeah.
Happy birthday with baby number one.
Yeah.
And currently in a Frank breech position.
Yes. Head's here, butt's there.
And planning the external version for tomorrow.
Yes.
So this is a timely discussion for you.
Yeah, so that's why I was excited to be here, so I could kind of have some opinions about doing the version at home without medication.
Ooh, I want you to hold on to that question for 1 second. It's mm-hmm. a great question. We're about to move into the version, but right before we get there, Milo was going to say one more natural thing about turning babies, which is positional things.
Yeah.
So there's a website, spinningbabies.com.
Mm-hmm.
Gail Thule, midwife, she's really laid out a lot of these exercises really beautifully with video, so you can see how to do them and suggestions on how to do them. What are your thoughts about positional exercises?
Yeah, well, I think it's just another option to add into the armamentarium. And that, you know, I've come across different descriptions of how to do it. Sometimes, you know, the mom face up, face down. It kind of strikes me that being face up at term is probably going to be very uncomfortable for most moms. So face down, you know, hands and knees makes a little more sense to me. And a simple way of describing it is, let's say you get on the ground on hands and knees, and then you just lower your chest down to the ground so your hips are kind of up in the air and your head is down low. And the idea is you're kind of turning your trunk upside down so that if the baby is, down in mom's pelvis, this gives a chance for the baby to kind of slide out a little bit and makes it a little easier for the baby to, work his or her way around.
And it also stretches the round ligaments that are running from the pubic bone up into the uterus. Those ligaments have muscle fibers and they can spasm. When they spasm hard, you feel it like an ice pick. But that tension also decreases the space for the baby to be able to move. So in addition to gravity helping bring the butt out or the foot out, whatever's stuck down there, you're also stretching out those round ligaments and helping. The remedy for that tight round ligament is to just stretch it and it relaxes.
And doing that position first thing in the morning when your bladder is full, they say, anecdotally, the weight of the bladder can help push the baby out. So again, you know, who knows?
They also said to keep your bladder empty, give it some more room. But okay.
Right, yeah. So maybe do it once before you empty your bladder and then come back.
I'm personally going to try it both ways tomorrow and see if it's more comfortable for me. Let's talk about the external cephalic version, because that's where Nusha's question is. The external cephalic version, first of all, the name of it, external cephalic version, meaning that it's external. Someone's going to, through the belly, try to manipulate the baby. Cephalic version means we're going to try to take the head as the cephalad portion and vert it from being up at the top down to the bottom. And it's commonly called either the ECV or the version. We've talked about why it can be done usually 36 or 37 weeks before that. If something were to go wrong, then we are concerned because the baby's not quite at term yet. After that, the odds of success really start to plummet. What are the things that can go wrong? And then I think this is where Nusha's question sort of comes in.
The protocol that I use is first the mother comes in, usually at 37 weeks. They have not don't have breakfast. Theoretically, keep the anesthesiologist happy in case she needs a cesarean section because it's an emergency, so they don't want it to have a full stomach and throw up. And
but that's never happened to one of your clients.
Never happened.
And
but
how many
that's theoretical.
How many years are you practicing external versions?
Over 30 years.
Okay.
And I've never seen it either.
I've never seen it either.
I've never seen it. But that's what theoretical.
You've never seen someone go into labor from the ECV?
No.
Because Nusha's convinced that she's going into labor tomorrow.
I have never seen going to labor.
So they certainly shouldn't eat the coyote salad in the morning.
When they come in, the first thing we do is scan them. Because,
make sure the baby's
because
still
make sure it's still breached. Because plenty of times I've gone there, oh, it's flipped already. And so we cancel it.
Berlin got this one head down already.
Okay. And then we get what's called a reactive non-stress test. We make sure the tracing, put a monitor on the baby, make sure the baby's doing fine and healthy. We then go ahead and I set the mother up. I use warm mineral oil because I warm up the mineral oil because then cold sort of shocks the abdomen. And basically I have an ultrasound there and I scan the baby. And basically I put my hands on the abdomen and I try to rotate the baby. I push the baby out and things like that. The secret is there's nothing on the top. Everything's from the bottom.
You're pushing the baby up.
Out of the pelvis. From the abdomen.
Out of the pelvis up towards the abdominal cavity.
I use the criteria that I don't cause any pain, discomfort, so I can't cause any harm because I stop if you start hurting the mother too much. So, you know.
But you would expect some level of discomfort.
Yeah, there is some level of discomfort, but I use her as a gauge. With the epidural, maybe a higher success rate, but I can't tell if I'm doing something.
How long does it usually take?
This is a 90-second procedure. I try one way, I try the other way. Mm-hmm. It's not, you're not trying for hours, it's minutes.
Is there medication involved?
You mentioned that you gave three tries to somebody.
Well, I mean, you keep on trying. I mean, it depends. I mean, obviously, the last time is going to be the successful one and you stop. But before I start this, I give a medication called terbutaline. Terbutaline is a medication we give for asthma, but what it does, it also contracts and relaxes the uterus. It causes the heart to race, and the mother feels some palpitations from that. We're very comfortable using that because a lot of times when we give Pitocin or for other reasons and they give too much, this is a medication we give to remedy that problem. So we're very familiar using that in obstetrics and it can be very helpful.
Is it just to get the uterus to relax to give you a greater chance of success or is it to prevent her from going to labor?
No, just to cause the uterus to relax.
Don't some people come in with just a very relaxed uterus to begin with?
Yes, but when I start pushing on it, it can start becoming more irritable.
How long does the terbutaline take to kick in?
I give it IV, maybe 5, 6, 7 seconds.
That's quick. But so couldn't she have the option? Because I know some of our more holistic minded moms, especially, they don't take anything during pregnancy. So they're a little nervous about taking terbutaline. Plus it makes the heart skippy, which also sometimes makes you a little bit more anxious. And that seems like that can be counterproductive.
Well, I run a success rate 60 to 70% during my versions.
That's high.
I've been trained to do it this way, and I find it effective doing this way.
Are you uncomfortable if a mom says, could we try
no,
it
that No, but I'm saying, I, you know, it may not be successful because the uterus do contract.
But 5 to 6 seconds, 7 seconds later, you can get some tributyline and try again.
I can. But so, usually I start off, it's a protocol I run through. And it's tough when you get trained some way and it's effective then, it works well, and I have no complications and no problems to switch to something different. So I like to do what works.
But you're the kind of guy that, because moms have individual needs and requests and desires, if somebody's uncomfortable with the medicine, it makes sense that you, and especially you can feel your uterus is pretty loose.
I take it back. I don't feel the uterus is loose. I feel the abdominal wall is loose, the muscles. You can feel. So the uterus itself, unless you see contractions, you really can't tell what's going on, especially when you start pushing it. The uterus may have a contraction. Now, because I don't use a continuous ultrasound monitoring. In other words, I start churning it. I listen to make sure the heartbeat's fine. I turn some more until I always listen to the heartbeat to make sure it doesn't fall down. Because remember, if you're stretching and pulling and you get the cord, I've had one case and I started turning, the heart went down, I had to push the baby back. I said, no, we can't go in that direction. So you do what's safe.
But Beth, do you, because you don't use ultrasound, and I feel like midwives who don't use ultrasound tend to have a finer palpatory touch. Do you feel like you can feel differences in a uterus that's taut versus a uterus that's contracting versus a uterus that's relaxed?
When it's contracting, but it's more the musculature of the abdominal wall.
You can definitely feel the musculature.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
you totally can.
Help it.
And it definitely makes a difference.
So I think it's a barrier to some of the patients that I work with, the tributyline, that they'd rather try sometimes first without it. Some don't care, but they'd rather try first without it. And then because it's a quick IV, quick acting IV drug, does it also come in pill?
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, but we use IV.
There is labor. Oral and then there's also intramuscular injection, which is also commonly used.
Are there brownies? No, okay.
We usually, the option is give subcutaneous
because you can't eat.
I like IV, it's very quick. And
there would be brownies, but you're not allowed to eat in case of that.
In case
you I gotta say, from my point of view, the literature is a little bit mixed on whether, you know, using these medications to relax the uterus help the overall success rate or not. You know, some studies show that it increases success rate and other studies don't, and it's kind of a mixed bag. So in my mind, it's a little bit of an open question. And I think, you know, the artful practice of medicine is trying to tailor it a little bit better to the individual patient. And do we think in this patient it's going to be maybe helpful, or in this patient maybe it's not going to, you know, make too big a difference? And I think you can always take a graduated approach. You can start at home with no medications, and if it's successful, then you win. And if it's unsuccessful, you could decide how far you want to increase your intervention using medications, go to the hospital, maybe get an epidural. I have some moms who, after a couple of tries, they kind of feel like, I've tried and I'm done and I don't want to do any additional steps. And you have other women that will go to the ends of the earth to try anything possible to try to, you know, get into cephalic presentation. And I think it's absolutely fine to, you know, kind of take an individualized and graduated approach.
Have you ever had an ECV turn into an instantaneous birth because of a complication?
Complication, no. The only time that's ever happened was when with ECV done when the patient was in labor.
Okay.
And so then you get the head down, and then the labor continues. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Beth, you have a thought.
I was just going to say, Mila was saying they'll go to the ends of the earth, and that's because they're not offered any other options.
Alternative.
So they want to have 3 children. They don't want to have the primary section. So they're going to try anything to do it.
Yeah.
If they knew that this guy over here can do a vaginal breech and this guy over here can do a vaginal breech, if they knew there were options,
and
if they are good candidates,
could do it if she wasn't in California.
Right.
See?
So that's a, you know, kind of an ethical dilemma for me.
Right.
Actually, because I know more than a lot of the doctors. I've seen it. I've done it. Mm-hmm. I have my hands on it. So what do you do? Be like, oh, I don't really know what to do. What do? You have to move.
Right. Did we answer the question that you had?
Yeah, and I just wanted to know, so basically the fear that everyone, all the people outside, try to put into a mom who has a breech baby doing a at-home birth is dependent upon the at-home birth with a breech baby would be more towards, or the version at home, is about the skill level of the doctor, and it's not potentially going to cause problems.
I think they're very different, the version and the birth at home. And it's not to say that they don't have potential complications. The question is, what are the complications and what are the rates? The complications, I think, from an external version that we worry about, the amniotic fluid sac can break, which would turn into a quick birth. If you're still breech and with a provider who doesn't do breech delivery, then it's a quick cesarean. If you're with a provider who does breech delivery and you're in a good position and things are progressing smoothly, then you have another option. Placenta, are we worried about the placenta
detaching?
The concern is you don't want to go ahead and start pushing and all of a sudden tear the placenta a little bit. I never had it happen, but I use pain as a criteria when I do the version, so I stop pushing, it's going to hurt. I mean, like I said, the reason theoretically it's set up to use this in the hospital, concording you have to do a cesarean section. But like I said, I've never seen
that.
Now, so I've had cases where while I'm doing it, the heart rate went down, I turn the baby back.
Heart rate normalizes for you.
After I turn the baby back.
Yes.
Stay down until I push the baby. I started
moving
the
baby and it wasn't
like
it. The baby wasn't tolerating it.
But that's another concern. If the heart rate goes down, it doesn't recover.
That's what I'm saying. You have to monitor it. That's right. You have to monitor while you're doing it.
But there is... there's ultrasound coming with you to that. So I know that I know.
Yeah.
I have seen it at home. I have seen it work at home, and I've seen it not work at home, just like
in the hospital.
Doing this at home or in the hospital, the reversion, I mean, the success rate should be basically the same.
Okay.
You're not going to do the epidural. I don't do the epidural anyways. The only thing is that theoretical risk if something happens. Like I said, I've never had it happen to me. As long as someone's monitoring, I think it's fine.
In terms of the external version, just to finish up that topic, what are some of the factors that make it more or less likely to succeed?
Well, we discussed.
We said a little bit.
Big
the
baby.
Position itself.
Decreased
well, the size
fluid.
Of the baby. If it's first or mother,
fluid.
Second
levels.
Mother.
Yeah.
If the placenta position, the placenta, less of the anterior. Lacks
fluid.
The strength of the abdominal muscles. Not as much the pelvic. I think the abdominal muscles of the mother. I have to be able to push on the uterus. If the mother's fortunately in great shape, and I try to go ahead and turn and her muscles contract involuntarily, I can't push on the uterus.
I think if Beth had a breech baby, we'd be in trouble.
I'd push that baby out.
I know you'd push it out. I'm saying we'd be in trouble for aversion. There's
oh,
just
yeah.
no way.
I don't
Whoever
think
tried
I,
it would
I
probably
don't think it
pass
would work
out.
You have no control over your involuntary contraction of your abdominal muscles, and you have to have it relaxed to push on the baby. If I try to push on it, your muscles involuntarily contract. I can't put any effort against the uterus to turn the baby.
Wouldn't you just say to make your job easier, at 32 weeks, all your breech babies should come see me?
And me.
Listen up, those muscles. And Susan, tag team, high five.
Yes, that's right.
We are going to take a quick commercial break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. All right. The fluid is just the one thing I want to talk about because I always ask patients when they come in, I always say, you know, how much fluid do you have?
Right.
And the answer I most commonly get is, oh, my fluid is good. But medically good and good for breech, I think, are two different things. Having an amniotic fluid index of between what would you say is normal, healthy-wise, forget about breech for a second. You want to see it above
9
and below...
Below 25.
Okay, so let's say 9 to 25. And we don't care. We're not worried about the health of the mother or the baby. But I think that in terms of breech, having more than 10, 11 is more helpful. I think babies 8 or 9, much harder to turn. And then when you get up to more than 16 or 17, you start to have these babies that just don't really appear to be stuck. They just have all this fluid in the swimming pool and those babies switch back and forth. So those problems, I think you have more of an issue of a much greater degree of success, but then those babies are more likely to flip back after the turn. So I always tell moms, and if you're listening in your breech, ask your provider how much amniotic fluid you have. These things make a big difference. The more fluid you have or the less fluid you have can increase or decrease your odds of success. Or maybe you don't even really have a problem. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because I get tagged on Facebook all the time when somebody says, hey, I got a breech baby, panic, panic, what do I do? And they're like, should I do the external? I get tagged as L.A. Berlin, goes to L.A. Berlin, the breech guru. I've been called that. But really, it's like, should I do the external version? And you get these answers like, no, don't do it. I tried it. It doesn't work. Well, it didn't work for you, or it's super painful, or you could go into labor, your placenta can come off, without really putting it into specific context for that individual person.
The data does
person.
Not obviously back those statements up.
No,
that's why the college of OBGYN college says you can try external podiatric version because you don't have the instance of all these ruptures and all these terrible things happen.
The weirdest thing I was ever tagged on is advice from a woman who says lay on an incline, positional. Right. And around the belly button, you're supposed to spread orange marmalade in a counterclockwise position.
That's a good one.
And then immediately I was like, yeah, strawberry in a clockwise position would never work.
Never.
I don't know. Anyway, Danielle, you came with a breech baby and you left with a not breech baby.
Yes.
But we didn't force your baby into any kind of position. It just kind of flipped over in there.
Right.
So how much fluid do you have?
I now have 19. I had 21 last week.
And yeah.
Blackjack. About 5 minutes after I left his office, I could feel a lot of movement. And throughout, and every single night around 4 a.m, I'm woken up by my baby and it feels like it's just flipping around and it's too easy.
Is your first baby?
First baby.
And so baby now, what position is the baby now?
Well, I had an ultrasound this afternoon. It was head down. It was head to the side and she just sort of tapped it and it was head down in the center. And I immediately put these tight bands on, okay. Which is what I have now.
You're good. Well, keep your fingers crossed.
But when's your baby due?
My baby's due 36 weeks almost.
Okay.
But my question for you guys is, I was surprised to hear earlier on, I can't remember who said it, something about if there is too much fluid to do the version later on and then immediately induce it.
Well,
because induction is something that I hadn't even thought of.
We're talking about that in unstable lie. In other words, baby's always flipping. So we run the problem trying to flip the baby. But once you get to, remember, most of the time as the time progresses, the fluid gets less and less. So this baby, hopefully, as the fluid gets less and less, baby grows and gets bigger. It'll stay in there. So, and the binder hopefully stays that. So every day that the baby stays in the vertex position, it's more likely to stay in the vertex position. So you have good odds going forward.
At 28 weeks, your baby has a lot of room to move around because they're not that big, right? And there's a lot of space and you got a roomy woomy there at 28 weeks. So babies can move around a lot at 28, and that's why so many of them are breech and we don't care. But somewhere after 32, between 32 and 35, they should start to run out of space in there and they're not as free to move about the cabin. They have to pick a position, head up or head down. And most commonly they pick head down. And that's great because it's the easiest way to get them out. But when you still have 21 cubic centimeters of fluid at 35 weeks, you're back to kind of like that 28-week scenario where they can move head up, head down freely, and they will. And so just because your baby, we can get the baby head down, what you've done is you put on these binders above the baby to artificially decrease the amount of space and, you know, not really let the baby keep moving, sloshing around like that in there. And the more you have the baby head down, and like Beth suggested, maybe doing squats to help open up the pelvis and bring the baby down, head down, more engaged.
I have good vibes for you, I think.
I have two belts on right now.
Yes.
But if the...
Sometimes I have two belts on.
As time progresses, the fluid will decrease. And remarkably, you know what I mean? And we have a concern, which is another scenario, when you get decreased under 5 centimeters, and we recommend considering delivering then. Of course, we have no randomized studies to say that's correct, but we do that. We're doing the study now. It's always back assward, but we're doing it now.
No pun intended.
Yeah.
It's true.
We're doing it backwards. We're doing the study now to say, which is basically the standard of care of inducing people when the fluid gets less than 5 centimeters. Now we're doing the studies. Is that the right thing to do? But welcome to medicine. But
so I'm not a medical doctor, but I have my hands on lots of breech babies every day, every week. I'm totally surrounded by breech babies. And what I'm going to tell you is your situation drives you nuts because the baby can flip back and forth. They drive you crazy at all, 38 or 39 weeks, which is why sometimes your medical provider will say, let's get the baby head down and go. I don't know. It's not, to me, it's not always a great idea, especially with your first baby, Because that baby's not anywhere, the head's not near your cervix. So we're trying to force this baby through a non-ripened cervix. And
well, the trouble is, if you induce, I'm a big fan. I don't induce first-time mothers. Now, just the opposite in second-time mothers, I offer them anything after 39. It's a social induction, which means not for medical reasons, just to coordinate with other kid at home want to do, because they already have a vaginal delivery. First-time mothers, I personally wait till 42 weeks. I follow them closely, fluids and NSTs, but I wait to 42 weeks because if you try to induce someone with not cervix is inducible, I think just markedly increases your
intersection. What if her cervix is 5 centimeters dilated?
It's easy.
That's a different story. But I mean, on average, if you take someone...
When's the last time? How many primates you've seen are 5 centimeters?
Handful.
Not many.
Sure,
yeah, handful. I've seen them, and then it's no problem. If your cervix is really dilated, very inducible. But if it's not, my temptation is... I like Mother Nature's to wait.
Danielle, do you know about the Bishop score? Have you seen the Bishop score? It's kind of a measure of how inducible you are. It takes into account your cervix. Is it effacing? Is it thinning out? Is it dilating? Is it starting to open up? How low down towards the cervix is your baby? Is the baby engaged and ready to come out? Each one of these things adds to your Bishop score. And the higher your Bishop score, the more likely it is that if we induce you, you're going to have, you know, an uneventful vaginal delivery. The lower your Bishop score, the more likely it is we're going to try to force this baby through a brick wall and it's not going to work and you'll probably end up in a cesarean anyway. So when you heard that, it was probably alarming to you, but I would say when you get these flip-flopping babies with high fluid, almost always at the end they end up in the right position. If nothing else, it's because they can easily just be flipped into the right position at the last minute.
So what makes a high amount of fluid alarming then?
Not yours, not 19.
Over 21.
So my appointment last week, I was traumatized by my doctor.
The way you make fluid is the baby pees, and the baby swallows the pee, and it's a vicious cycle. If there's a blockage in the swallowing part, then the fluid can markedly increase. And we have certain tricks we look at to see that, and that's one of the criteria. So the major problem, the increased fluid, the number one problem if that happens, you get not 25, 40, 50, 60 centimeters of fluid at 28, 29 weeks, and they go into premature labor. So that's a major problem. So that's what we call polyhydramnios, or too much fluid. So we use a criteria of 25. Gestational diabetics have increased, or diabetics have increed fluid sometimes. But you're looking massive. The problem with the fluid is indication of something's going on, but the major problem is delivered prematurely. So you're not, that's not a problem.
Yeah, and for you, it's not, at 19, it's not really a concern at all.
It's
yeah.
normal.
Yeah. No, it's, you're, it's a, normal. You're a normal level. You have above adequate fluid, but not abnormally high fluid. You've been listening to the Informed Pregnancy and Parenting Podcast, Breech Babies 101, Part 2. For show notes, visit informedpregnancy.com. And as always, if you have questions, write to info@informedpregnancy.com.
This episode is sponsored by an innovative product that's made a big difference for parents and babies alike, Dr. Mom Butt Balm. As a parent of four, I've had my fair share of battles with diaper rash, often resorting to thick, unpleasant pastes. I only recently discovered Dr. Mom Butt Balm, and I was immediately impressed by its pleasant consistency and ease of application. This pediatric-approved skin protectant is free from dyes, preservatives, and zinc oxide, making it perfect for your baby's sensitive skin. It's designed by a doctor who's also a mom, ensuring your little one gets the gentlest care. A small dab is all it takes to soothe and protect, avoiding the mess and hassle of traditional treatments. With ingredients like dimethicone and petrolatum, Dr. Mom Butt Balm not only soothes, but also restores your baby's delicate skin. Available on Amazon.com and Walmart.com, it's the smart choice for every parent wanting to keep diaper rash at bay. Remember, with Dr. Mom Butt Balm, nothing comes between you and your baby, not even diaper rash.